Yeah. Here we are, back again. Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human-crafted radio. I am your host, Wes Geer, and it's also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have great they have great programs out there for all sorts of people, mental health issues, professionals, addiction, etc. I always start the show off by saying, why are we here? I am a sober guy. Somehow out there, I did not die. And if you knew me back in the party days, most of you, many of you thought I was going to die. And somehow I didn't. And what happens oftentimes in this world of recovered souls, we love to get out there and help people. So somehow I got gifted this radio show, and it's kind of like something I wanted to do. So what we do on the show is we talk about addiction. We talk about the struggles of life. We've talked to wounded warriors, PTSD, mental health patients, people, all sorts of people, rock stars, celebrities, models, exceptional earthlings, rad humans, to try to bring to light the stuff that so many people try to handle on their own, you know, get isolated by maybe addiction or mental health. And that's when we perish. So the more we bring it out to the light, the more we talk about it, the more we share about it, hopefully the people who are struggling can find strength in that, find support, find answers, get information, whatever. That's what we're here to do. It's a great honor and privilege to be here. So this week's guest, now see, people on Facebook, they can see what's up. People listening, you guys don't know. So in the studio with me is, now let me see, jump in wherever you want, but let me see if I get this right. So former Playboy model.
Playboy TV Playboy star, TV. And I was in Playboy magazine once, but I wouldn't say Playboy model. I was okay. A Playboy TV host.
See, I already screwed up.
So that's screwed what up I... big time. Most people do.
That's all right. And that's what I wrote on FaceTime. So that's all right. That's good. Nobody used to say head PE right ever. So there's that. Okay. And also, after that, you got
Get to the important stuff.
Yeah, you got to, you did a more mortician science.
I was an embalmer. I was a funeral director and embalmer. I went to school to be a mortician. I have a degree in mortuary science.
Mortuary science. That's what I was trying to say. Mortuary science. That's very interesting. And then, I mean, almost like comedically, obviously, you went from mortuary science into a band for which you are one of two singers called Butcher Babies.
Yeah, but okay, just so you know, Butcher Babies is the title of a plasmatic song, Butcher Baby. So, you know, I'm not really offing any small defenseless children or killing babies. We had a cop pull us over on the road once, and he said, "What in the hell is a butcher baby?" But no, it is the title of an old plasmatic song, so that's how we chose that name. But yes, it is a little bit creepy, I guess, if you didn't know me and you knew that I was an embalmer and co-fronted a band called Butcher Babies, you might think I was kind of a little bit of a weirdo.
Yeah, well, they seem to go together. And by the way, I used to love the plasmatics. Yeah. I saw Wendy O. Williams play up in L.A. many moons ago.
She's an incredible woman. She was an incredible woman.
Incredible woman. And you're an incredible illustrator. You've been a writer. You did a comic book. And by the way, we haven't told them who you are. Carla Harvey. Oh. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you. Yeah. Thanks for coming down. You brought moms.
I did. My mom is visiting me from Detroit. Hi, so she's out under the glass taking pictures of us like a creep.
I love it.
I love it, too.
That's so cool. My mom takes pictures, but she prefers the iPad. And I'm trying to get her to do it on the iPhone because it's easier to handle. So
that would drive me bananas if I had to watch her with an iPad all day, too.
So she'll come out with a big old iPad like, I'm taking a picture. It's cute. Yeah, moms are cute, aren't they? Anyhow, so super stoked you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really cool. We have a lot of mutual friends, and I've seen around the social media corridor. And so it's nice to finally meet you in the flesh.
Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah, yeah. So another thing that I'll kind of preface our chat with is, we were talking about before the show, I'm like completely sober. I can't touch anything. It goes bad. I've experimented enough with that. It's deadly for me. And your recovery is a little bit different, and we'll get into it. But you definitely had some issues with drugs.
For people that have read my book, Death and Other Dances, or people mm-hmm. who know me closely, you know that I had a huge problem with drugs from the time I was 18 years old until 2007 is when I stopped using cocaine. So it was a huge part of my life. I couldn't function without it. And but like I said, I've been sober for off drugs for 11 years now, and it's amazing how much my life has changed and how many dreams I was able to accomplish mm-hmm. right off the bat.
Yeah.
As soon as you stop. We were talking earlier, though, about alcohol. I still drink alcohol. I don't drink excessively. Mm-hmm. I love a glass of wine, but I never had a problem with alcohol. I didn't have a sip of alcohol until I was around 25. Mm-hmm. Didn't care for it, didn't want a part of it. Cocaine was it for me. I didn't care about anything else. I didn't even smoke pot. You know, I don't know if it's a weird anomaly. I don't know if there's other people like me that develop a huge problem with one drug and don't really touch anything else. But that's what I am. And I like I said, I'll never touch cocaine again. I can't. It was a huge problem for me. I almost lost my life to that drug. But as far as anything else is concerned, I don't have a problem right now. Now, I do think that when you have an addictive personality and it's hereditary, you know, my father was an addict, my grandfather died of alcoholism, you always have to be careful and realize that mm-hmm. you have the tendency to do that. So if there comes a time when I'm drinking and I'm having that glass of wine and I'm thinking, man, I really want three more bottles right now,
yeah.
then I have to be self-aware and understand that I do have the potential to become an alcoholic at any time. I do have addictive tendencies, but right now, you know,
you're cool.
I'm okay. I'm not fine. I can go have a glass of wine with dinner and that's it. And that's fine.
Insane
and
that's to me.
Once a week or a couple times a week, or if I'm on tour, I can have, you know, a shot of Jaeger and I'm not going to go off the deep end. I'm the first one in bed, the first one up. Mm-hmm. I just don't have a problem with it. But like I said, people with addictive personalities, you never know when something happens in my life that I can't control that might send me in a downward spiral with that. So you have to be aware at all times, but
you have it in your, maybe in your DNA potentially, yeah. right? Because you had it in your family, and mm-hmm. and we know that it is passed hereditarily, and they say more strongly on the father's side. Yeah. But this is great, and I told you we do the Rock Recovery Program, right? We go out and we do basically music therapy. We go into treatment centers in a variety of settings, and. For relevance of what I'm talking about now, we worked with a lot of people. And like I said, me and my guys, we're all 100% sober. We have to be, or we'll literally perish. So when we would meet people like you, it would almost like a cog in our motor. What? You can't have wine you get it so indoctrinated. And that's why I think in some ways, there's probably people listening tonight going, well, she's not totally sober, so why is she on the show or whatever? But it's, you know, things show us what we are and things show us what we aren't. And so, you know, it's good to show the other side of it. You know what I mean?
No, I totally agree. I think that, you know, everyone is different. Your body chemistry is different and your story is different. And like I said, if you read my novel, Death and Other Dances, it's a chronicle of my journey getting off drugs. And, you know, I mean, it was a huge problem for me, like I said.
Well, we'll get into that,
yeah.
And I'm going to take you through your story. But the one other thing I wanted to point out is I go through this all the time with people. Look, will you just use the expression alcoholic, and we'll use alcoholic as defined by the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just to make a point of reference. And what it talks about in there, and this was at a time when they weren't sure they couldn't help alcoholics of this certain type. And they had this hypothesis that we think it's an allergy. What happens is when an alcoholic of this class drinks, and I found even drug addicts can have this same thing happen, an allergic reaction goes off that creates the phenomenon of craving. Now, see, you alluded to that in saying body chemistry is different. If I drink a glass of wine, and I've tested it when I relapsed, I didn't mean to test it, I got some more data. But as soon as I was actually with Mike Dirt from Green Day, my fiance at the time, and his chick. And I was like, I think I'm going to drink, you guys. And I had, like, they poured me half of a Corona. Yeah, just don't do drugs. That's your problem, right? And as soon as I had a sip of that Corona, and I didn't think beer was my problem, I was like, oh, my God, I want to drink, like, 12 Coronas.
Well, I also think, too, in the beginning of my sobriety from cocaine, I couldn't go out and drink. Mm. Because at that time, if I drank, it would send me, even if I had, mm-hmm. you know, a glass of wine or a glass of whiskey, it would put me in that mindset where I got to find that cocaine now. Mm, I got to, you know, I have to find that. So back then it would have been terribly detrimental for me to, to drink and do that.
That's interesting. That's
but
cool.
Now I feel like I can go out and have a drink. I can go to a party
and keep it.
Cocaine
control.
Can be in the next room and I won't lose my mind.
That's good to know. And, you know, we were talking about it, some friends and I, and it was, you know, one good way of saying is if when you pick up, you aren't sure what's going to happen, that's a good indication that you have this other thing that we were talking about a second ago. So let's get into your story, though. Who knows where your addiction starts? For people, it's often different. Sometimes it's some childhood trauma or some stuff that happens early in life. Oftentimes people don't feel good when they're young.
You know, I grew up in Detroit. I'm biracial. So
what are you, by the way?
I'm half black and half Italian and Finnish.
Wow, cool.
So I grew up in a place that was very racially divided. So from mm-hmm. a very young age, I didn't really have I didn't have friends. I had people that were always staring at me. I thought I was a weirdo as it was. My father was an addict. He was never around. He was always out drinking, partying. My mother never touched alcohol or drugs at all. So mm-hmm. very strange that they even hooked up. But I felt very alone from the time I was a child. And then my dad left and I had, you know, obviously, you know, it's a story a lot of us people from my generation have, you know, our dads left us and we have no strong male figure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have had a strong male figure regardless, even if he was present.
Yeah.
But when you lose that and you have other problems, and then middle school, I had something very horrible happen to me, or I had a boy that I thought was my boyfriend, and he ended up molesting me instead. And so I had a lot of.
How old were you when that happened?
11. So I had a lot of. Negativity and loss early on in my life, very early. And I never felt worthy of anything. Mm. I was very chubby, frizzy haired. Like I said, the biracial thing was very, very difficult in the neighborhood that I grew up in because it was wrong. And people wanted me to pick a side. And
that's what I've heard.
It was very, very difficult.
So you're not dark enough for mm-hmm. black and you're not white enough for white.
So it was just so much. And so many people out there have these issues.
Sure.
But I had no strong. My mother was always working to mm-hmm. take care of us. So I literally had no one at home. I was basically raising myself and I have a younger brother. And
did you know you were hurting? Because sometimes we're hurting and we don't realize it because it's just how
it
is.
It's just how it is. I always say I was like a born hustler. Mm. I just hustled my way through life in a way because I had to get by. I've had so many people tell me I'm too independent or I'm not sensitive when it comes to relationships or I don't cater to other people. And I think it's because since I was very young, I had to take care of myself and I didn't have anyone to rely on but myself. Mm. But more so than that, like I just the emptiness that I felt and, you know, the low self-worth. And I started dancing when I was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I had ever seen anyone do cocaine. And I had never drank. Like I said, I never did anything
But
I remember a girl in the dressing room, never even a sip. I had a sip once. I remember having a sip of alcohol, watching an Aerosmith video. Janie's Got a Gun came mm-hmm. on and I had a sip of alcohol with my girlfriend. We thought that was it. I didn't care for it.
You guys didn't break out the bottles and go, hey, let's get a buzz.
It just wasn't in me. But I don't even know why I did cocaine the first time. But the girl,
you were dancing.
I wanted
what
her
kind
to be
of
my friend. I didn't have any friends, and she was doing cocaine, and she's like,
self-esteem.
Try this.
trying
and
to fit
I'm
in.
Telling you, from the second I tried cocaine, I thought to myself, I feel, for the first time, I feel like I'm somebody. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had a personality, mm-hmm. you know, because I was so shy and introverted because of all the things that had happened to me at a young age. I felt like I could talk to anybody. I was up on stage dancing, and I felt good
dancing?
About myself. Oh, I was a dancer for...
What kind of dancing?
Oh, you know what kind of dancing.
I want to say it. I mean, the audience at home.
I was an exotic dancer.
Exotic dancer.
Yeah.
Are we talking topless, nude?
Topless. They have topless bars.
Is this in Detroit?
Detroit back then. And, you know,
so you
that
started
was
doing that
thing,
at
too. 18? I never felt pretty my whole life. And because everyone told me I wasn't pretty. Mm. You know, I was just chubby, frizzy-haired, ugly biracial kid and who always got made fun of. And so... You know, I knew I could make money that way because I wanted to move to L.A. So
did
I was,
your mom know that you went to?
She didn't know at the time.
Kind of snuck off
no,
and did it.
No, I moved out of the house early because my mom got remarried and I had a stepfather who I didn't get along with at all. So I moved out. So she didn't
How
know.
How was that when you didn't get along? You just didn't get along or what? Did it get pretty
My mom,
gnarly?
You know, he was very, he had mental problems. I don't really talk about this a lot. He had mental problems and I could sense it. I was a very, sensitive child and I could feel just something wrong with his presence. They're still married today. So I hate to say these things about my stepdad, but he was definitely off and he needed to be on, he needed treatment and he's getting treatment now, which is great.
Good. That's amazing. Yeah.
But it did make my life, you know, which was already pretty crappy.
Yeah.
It made it pretty bad.
Especially in the male realm.
Yeah.
Right? Because your mom seems super awesome. So you had that handle. Mm-hmm. But so far, guys in your life, it's
My
not going so well.
My mom is super awesome. She was beautiful and she worked her butt off to take care of us. But, you know, when you have your mom working her butt off,
yeah,
you know, 8-10 hours a day, she's not around.
My
to
mom
watch
was the
what's
same
going
way.
On, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it happens to a lot of us nowadays, especially now you see these kids, they're in front of an iPad or a computer or video games all day because their parents are both working their butts off to take care of them. And it's like, but you don't have that one-on-one interaction. She wasn't around to look at me and say, something's not right.
Yeah.
I need to take care of this. You know, she just couldn't. She physically couldn't. She had to take, my dad wasn't paying child support. So what are you supposed to do?
She got to work.
Take care of the basic necessities before the mental necessities.
And I think
know?
For our parents, when they're doing that, they feel like, hey, I am doing what I got to do. That is the primary function. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're in a society now where we talk about feelings and upbringing and all this stuff. And but the generations before us, they didn't talk about it, right?
No, they didn't.
It never came up. So we learned a lot now.
Yeah. But my stepdad, you know, we just couldn't get along. And it really, I started to really resent my mother for bringing someone into the picture who was just as, you know, who was worse than my dad had been.
Because your dad
wasn't
there.
So I just left, you know, and I said, you know what? It's cool. I was born a hustler. I'm going to start this dancing and I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to put myself through college and I'm only going to do it for a little while. And I'm going to, you know, and, that's the dream, but it never happens that
way. It's a tough career to get out of.
It is very tough.
I dated a full nude dancer, mm-hmm. best girlfriend I ever had in many ways. But you make your own hours, you make tons of money, the freedom. I mean, that way.
It's hard to transition into the real world. Even, you know, after going to college and starting my first job at a mortuary, when I had to open up a mortuary at 8:00 in the morning. I would stroll in at 9:00. You know what I mean? I had to change my whole pattern of thinking after dancing.
What happens when you're not at the mortuary on time? It's like people outside with dead bodies going, hey, let us in.
I only did that once or twice. No, I'm.
That is a trippy
visual. I loved my job and I was very respectful of it. And, you know, going to mortuary college, you have to be there. You only can miss a couple days. It's very intensive.
Hmm.
And so you have to, like I said, I had to really retrain my brain after years of dancing and doing drugs to have a real career.
It saved
my life, honestly.
Well, we'll
so
get
I'm
to that in a second.
But back to my stepdad moving out. But so I moved out when I was young and I supported myself doing that. And I had a plan to save all my money and move to California. And what was the point? I forgot.
Oh,
so I was in the dressing room one day.
Yeah, the cocaine.
And this girl, I remember her dancer name was Secret.
And I can't imagine there being cocaine at a strip club.
I know.
Club.
Can you imagine that? What a strange world we live in. But she wore the same outfit every day. And I'll never forget this girl. I mean, I can picture her clear as day standing in front of me.
What was her name?
Secret.
And that's a cool one. And what was your stage name?
My first stage name was, I had to think of one on the fly when I went to audition. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't think of anything.
When you go to audition, you got to have your whole shtick together?
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't even have, I had on a bra and some underwear and some cowboy boots.
Like,
and I went up on stage.
Oh, now I need a name?
And they're like, what's your name? And I'm like, crap, a name?
Uh-huh.
So I said Rio because I knew the Duran Duran song, but I don't even like Duran Duran, so I don't know why.
That's a cool name. I like it, Rio, because you didn't go with the standard, you know.
So then I changed it to Ty, and I was Ty for a long time. Yeah, I liked that one. And then people always said, it's like a Ty stick, and I said, what? Because I didn't smoke pot. I never smoked pot. But back to Secret and her cocaine.
Her blow.
So her boyfriend was the bouncer.
Of course.
He sold drugs, of course.
Yeah.
You couldn't get any more cliche than the
story. If you put that in a movie, they'd be like, too obvious. Give me something fresh. I need something fresh.
So she gave me a line of coke. And like I said, it changed everything for me. I felt, like I said, I went from being very shy and introverted to being like outgoing and just, I felt pretty and I felt, you know, excited to be alive. And I felt like I could take on the world.
Yeah.
And that feeling lasted for a long time. And then
so that was at 18.
It goes away.
So at 18, so you moved out from mom at 17, you said?
Yeah,
17. So you're on your... By the way, I wanted to just say, you remind me of another girl I know, very similar story, and her coping mechanism for a very similar life was to just handle her biz. Like, that was how she beat, like, this bad life was, I'm going to take care of myself. So I hear that independence, that ambition.
Well, when the people that are supposed to take care of you from the time you're born aren't there to take care of you, you develop that.
Some do.
Some do. I mean,
you did.
I did. And I just had that tenacity since I was a kid. And I was like, if I'm going to take care of myself, I'm going to do what I want and get it how I can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And that's the reason I've been successful in the music business as well, you know, in any business.
Once you get the other stuff out of the way.
I think it's a great life skill to have that. I wish I had been able to get that life skill in a nicer fashion.
Mm.
But whatever.
You got it. Yeah.
Got it.
So Secret and Rio do some blow.
Yeah, all of a sudden we're best friends.
This is in Detroit?
Know?
What was the name of the spot?
Henry the Eighth's.
Henry the Eighth's.
Mm-hmm.
Henry the Eighth's. You're doing some blow. So... You did it, and it helped with your self-esteem, everything. You would say, like, what Popeye, what Spinach did for Popeye?
I would exactly say that.
Yeah. Right. Shiver me timbers or something like that. So what happened? Where did it go from there? Did you instantly start buying it all the time?
Oh, yeah. There was a guy that would come in. His name was Waldo. And so we would always say, where's Waldo? And we would pretend to be giving him. And that day, too, dancing was so much more innocent. It really was. Like, it wasn't. Like these raunchy dances in the back. It was literally dances out in the front, and you dance in front of a guy. And so Waldo.
You're talking the table dance part?
Yeah, Waldo would go sit in the corner, and you would go and you pretend to be giving Waldo a dance, but really you'd be buying your.
Was he a customer?
Drugs. He was a customer.
Wow.
Well, a customer, but more like
yeah.
He worked. He had his little business there. So,
right.
Yeah.
He had a little racket going on.
Mm-hmm.
For people who don't know at home, strip clubs, they go and they dance on stage. The girl, and many, the format is off typically like this. The girls dance on stage. You see them, you throw some dollars, whatever. Then they come around and they offer you a table dance or a private, depending on the level of the club. Some of them, you get a table dance where they dance for you, maybe bounce on your lap a little bit, right? Not that I've ever experienced this, but I've seen it in a movie. And the, depending on the club, you can have a private where they'll bounce in your lap in a back room, and then that's the dividing line. Sometimes a lot more.
Oh, yeah, there's some places that are pretty gross. But
And guys expect it, but your place wasn't like that.
Honestly, I feel like dancing has changed so much over the years. Back in the day, it really was about – and it, even for me, I'll honestly say throughout my whole career, and it was a career. It's actually made me great conversationalist with literally anybody, any human being I can think of.
Because you got to go talk.
Because you have to talk to everybody. It was a great job to form life skills that are needed in any job.
But if you don't come out too mangled emotionally and sexually. Yeah.
Exactly. You have to have a very strong sense of self to do it. And I wouldn't recommend it. I do not recommend it.
Which is ironic because you didn't go in with a strong sense of self.
No, I didn't. But I came out with one. And I definitely wouldn't recommend that young girls.
It's a cool story. It's atypical.
Again, back then, and there's certain types of, I was the kind of dancer that I would sit and talk with a customer.
That's how you get the money, right?
They keep handing me 20s just to have a couple. Because
did you ever cry and pretend that you didn't have, because I knew girls, they would make the big money, not by the dances, but they'd be like, I can't pay my rent. I'm like $1,000 short. Oh, here you go, baby. And then they would get the big dollars.
I never needed to cry for it. I look back with fondness at some of those years or some of the people that I came in contact with. Because a lot of these guys that go in there, they're just guys that are normal guys that are kind of, you know, disenchanted with their family life. Maybe their wife doesn't pay any attention to them, or they're getting the, you know, the short straw at work, whatever. And they just, you know, they have a crappy day and they come in and they want someone to talk nice to them.
Yeah,
and
a pretty girl.
And they want someone. Nice. They want someone to listen to them for once. No one listens to anybody. Everyone wants to talk about themselves, but nobody wants to like listen. And people really.
You guys probably hear a lot of stories.
Oh yeah, so many stories. I know everything about everyone's kids and wives at those places. You know what I mean?
And this is before the interwebs.
Oh yeah.
Which, in that sense, can connect some people. But yeah.
Oh yeah, but you know, a lot of these guys were just. They just wanted to talk to somebody. It was, for them, that was more sexy than getting a lap dance.
Connection.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to slip in the song now. This, I'm really enjoying this story, and I appreciate your openness and vulnerability and honesty and all that. So we're sitting here with Carla Harvey, Playboy, how am I supposed to say?
Playboy TV star.
Playboy TV star, author, writer, illustrator, and half of the lead singing tandem
and honestly,
of Butcher Babies.
Playboy was just, I don't talk about it that much because I didn't, in the grand scheme of things, I think it's like this. It was interesting to me when I was young, but my life is so much cooler than Playboy.
But you were on TV.
But it was. I did 100 episodes of The Weekend Flash. I was an entertainment reporter.
I get it what you're saying, but it is
something that people are interested in, so I'm willing to talk about it. But it's funny to me how Playboy gets, people always want to hear Playboy, and it's such a... It just seems like...
Well, it's like I played with Korn, and I played what they wanted me to play. I did much more creatively, artistically, and had PE, but people are like, oh, you're in Korn. You played... Well, I wasn't in. That's just how people are. It's exactly the same. Anyhow, so we're here with Carla Harvey, who's telling this amazing story of, her life in general. And we're right at the part where you discovered cocaine, and you love it, and it's given you magical powers, so you thought. And... So this is Wes Geer on Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM. And what's our song we're jumping into?
Well, are we doing It's So Easy first?
There you go. Yeah. It's So Easy. GNR?
Yeah.
This song just makes...
Guns N' Roses provided the soundtrack to my youth and my early 20s, so...
Their songs are kind of feel druggy, don't they?
Are you kidding me? Of course.
I know.
It made me want to move to L.A. and be part of it all.
Oh, dang. Okay, we're still in Detroit in the story. We'll find out about that in a second. We'll be right back. This is GNR.
Everybody tried to please me, baby. It's so easy.
I love some GNR. So glad they got back together. All right, here we are back on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear, on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. Also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have great treatment programs if you're looking for one out there. We are sitting here with Carla Harvey. I for the life of me, always forget. But you did a Playboy TV show. You wrote a book. You'd read a novel. I love the name of your novel. Say
Thank you. Death and Other Dances.
Death and Other Dances. Yep.
And it's... Do you want to know why it's called that?
You can tell us. Yeah.
It's called that because it's written about these early years that we were just talking about, the dancing part.
Mm. Okay.
And then my mortuary career. So, and the connection, the human connection in both of those careers. And so that's the name.
Yeah, and she is also the lead singer of Butcher Babies, which is named after a Plasmatics song. Yes. Wes remembered something. No way. Wow. He has
You'd
brain
be surprised
cells.
At how many people ask Heidi and I, if we're running a weird abortion clinic or something, man. You know.
Fans, I'll just put it in the category of fans ask some stupid questions.
Well, everyone should know the Plasmatics. If you're into females who rock, you should know the Plasmatics.
And that's so funny. I'm glad you pointed that out. Right. She's a female. You're a female. She rocks. You rock. I get it now. It makes all the more sense. So thanks for being here. Where we are in the story is we're talking about how Carla, at this point, though she's Rio, had a tough life. Dad was addict who wasn't around, mom remarried, some definite struggles with the stepdad. You had a boyfriend who sexually assaulted you, so you had some tough time. But you're talking about turning into a very ambitious girl, handling your business. You moved out prior to turning 18.
But I finished school. I wanted to add that in. School's always been hugely important to me. I love learning. I always got straight A's in school. So, I think people have the misconception that girls who turn to dancing to make some money are dumb and they can't do anything else.
Stereotype.
I could have done anything I wanted to, but I wanted to save up money and move to LA. So that was the path that I chose. I got scholarships to every college that I applied to. But I wanted to move to LA and play music, and so I took a different path. But school to me was hugely important. So no matter what I had going on at home, I made sure that I excelled in school.
School was always part of your plan.
Important.
That's cool to know. And so you're dancing at Henry VIII's in Detroit, and you saw a girl named Secret doing some cocaine in the dressing room. And you tried it, and you said it gave you self-esteem and confidence and all this stuff.
I've never felt like I could talk to people or be myself. And I was very introverted, as I was saying earlier. And the feeling was just so elating. And I felt like $1 million. And I felt like I could take on the world. And I had never felt that way before in my life, in any circumstance.
Right.
I always felt very downtrodden. I always walked with my head down. You know, I didn't think much of myself. So that changed my mindset.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, after the first night and you're like, wow, this is amazing. I think a lot of people have that experience with cocaine, hence how dangerous it is.
Yeah.
I have somebody very close to me went down a similar path. What was the next step? What did you started getting it from?
Secret's boyfriend, of course.
Waldo. From Waldo.
And then Waldo.
Waldo the regular who is selling cocaine. So you're 18 when you get into it.
Yeah.
How does that progression go? You were in Detroit.
Well, obviously, you know, you tell yourself, okay, I'm just going to do it a little bit to like get through this time, make this money. And then, but obviously cocaine for me became something that my body relied on, you know.
How quickly did you get to that phase?
I'd say within a month, because I was surrounded in that atmosphere by people who did drugs all day, and it was completely normal for them to have a bullet of cocaine in their their pocket at all times. And I worked every day of the week, you know, 7 nights a week, because it was fun for me. I felt like I was part of a crew all
How
of a sudden.
How much money were you making?
Oh gosh, back then, and where all the auto workers had money, it was awesome. It was
a few grand
a
week.
You're making at least a couple grand a week, but you're a kid, so you're spending that money as fast as you make it.
A couple grand a week when you're young is
But
like,
I did save. I saved up $10,000 to move to LA, and that was my plan, and I put it away, and that was
at
my LA money.
That's impressive. Somebody who has a cocaine problem, although you're probably getting a lot of free cocaine. I mean, you're
sorry,
a girl
girls get free drugs.
I know the women experience.
Yeah, I saved up the money by the time I was 19 to move to
LA. A year? Mm-hmm. Wow. That's pretty impressive. So at this point, you're like, cocaine isn't a problem. Look at, I'm just making moves.
You never think it's a problem.
Right.
Especially when everyone around you is doing the same thing as you. It's
right.
It's glamorous and it's fun and everyone's doing it. And it didn't really, I knew that in the back of my head that I shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
But it didn't become a problem for years. I mean, it was always a problem. Looking back, my mood swings were intense. Mm. You don't realize what a crappy person you are when you're doing drugs.
Right.
You know, you don't, especially when you're surrounding yourself with other people who do them. But the things that I would
do,
the way that I would talk to people, and even the way that it made my dreams further in the distance. Like, you think that you're getting so much stuff done, but you're really getting nothing done. And, you know, when I first moved to L.A., I got an agent, one of the biggest agents in L.A., CAA, I think it was. And I was in their youth division, and I was going to get all these commercials. And they were sending me out. The first audition I went to, I got for it was for a commercial. But then I would just be doing cocaine all night and not go to my auditions.
Yeah.
So there I was shutting the door on my own dreams because I wanted to get high.
And you kind of go into denial about that.
Yeah. And even the stuff that I loved, you know, I always drew. I went to art school for a while.
You can draw.
And thank you. I stopped drawing. Didn't care to draw. I'd rather be, you know, doing drugs than drawing or going out to the bar. And everyone goes through that phase, I think, where you're a young adult and you want to party a little bit. I took it to another level, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I literally stopped focusing on my dreams, and that's the worst thing. You know, I made it that far. I saved up my money. I drove my little Ford Probe across the country. I got an apartment in LA. There I was. The dreams were, you know, I was ready to pursue my life. And then you get caught up in stupid stuff.
Wow, you're making me think of my story.
Yeah, and you just, I don't care what anyone tells you, you cannot be creative while doing cocaine. It makes you a mess, and it made me a mess. I came here with purpose, and I lost that purpose snorting stuff up my nose. So,
mm-hmm. So when did you go? You said you were chubby, frizzy hair, but then you get CAA.
You
were dancing.
Middle school, high school.
So you had the.
I lost weight by the time I was, you know.
Because you're obviously a very beautiful woman.
A lot of self doubt is in your head when you're young too. Mm-hmm. You think of yourself as so ugly.
Insecure. Yeah.
And because you're insecure, I mean.
Did you come to a point where you're like, hey, I'm pretty good looking?
I still don't I don't think when you are raised a certain way or when you grow up an ugly kid, I don't think that you really ever look in the mirror and think, you know, gosh, I'm good looking. You don't have that chip all the time. And I'm okay with that. I don't, you know,
I totally
I think
that.
There's a little bit of a beauty and humility. And, you know, obviously I would like to feel like, you know, I mean, I love taking selfies and putting on makeup and putting on nice clothes, but I still think I have a lot of humility.
It's an interesting thing because this book I've been reading, and it talks about your wisdom not being knowledge or book read stuff, but it's like truly knowing your truth, mm-hmm. with a capital T, meaning your worth and how loved you are. And so it's an interesting thing, society we live in, because the ego gets in the way. People are narcissistic. But at the same time, it should be okay to be in your wisdom and know, I'm a beautiful woman, or I'm a handsome man.
Wonderful to be able to look in the mirror
self-love.
And feel that way. And I think it's even more wonderful to look inside yourself and say, hey, you know what? I may have this little scar here, some laugh lines, but you know what? I have a beautiful soul. I'm a grief practitioner. I help people. I make a difference in someone's life. Those are the things that really mm-hmm. matter. Especially when you start realizing that, you know, once you get past your 20s and you get past the narcissistic stages of life, you realize that all these other things that you've been building your whole life long, hopefully you've been building them your whole life long, are what truly make you a beautiful person. And the light that shines through your eyes when you are happy with what you're doing. Like, gosh, I mean, I went from doing drugs all night long to now I'll be sitting at my desk drawing all night. And just the feeling of elation that I have when I'm sitting there working and the beauty that I feel, it's like that's what's special.
I love that. That when we use our passion to create, to mm-hmm. quote, work, that just grows beautiful energy from the inside.
And when I am living my passion, I literally do not think about the scar on my face or maybe I should start getting filler or Botox. You just don't, your brain doesn't think like
because
that.
You're
because
fulfilled.
You're focused and you're doing something else. It's when I'm not working that the trickery starts to go in your head, like you're not good enough or special
right.
enough or pretty enough.
Well, we're not working.
All that crap that doesn't matter.
And we're not cultivating that love and passion inside of us. We start looking for outside gratification.
And that goes for, you know, the drug use as well. When you're happy and fulfilled, you don't want to use. Going to mortuary college saved my life in the sense that it gave me something that I was so passionate about for the first time in my life that I didn't want to do drugs. I didn't want anything to
so
mess with my mind.
So was that when you quit before you went into there?
Yeah, I had an ordeal.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So when you did was the Playboy gig like the first kind of main gig you got in L.A.?
It was. I did a lot of little acting jobs, but the Playboy gig was the biggest gig I had ever gotten.
And
I was
we're just doing
a ton
tons of
money,
blow then?
And I was doing a ton of blow and you know, I thought I was lighting the world on fire and really I was doing a lot of damage to myself. I wasn't happy because when you work at Playboy, you know, I was an entertainment reporter for the Naked News. It's so funny thinking about it now to me. I think it's just hysterical. But when you're not using your brain to do something, I was reading off a teleprompter and at first it's exciting, you know, you're working with Playboy. Who doesn't dream of that when you're a kid? But when you're not using your brain and it becomes very, you know, very stagnant. And for me, that stagnant atmosphere and the cattiness and the, you know, people telling me I was fat and people, that was so long ago that we didn't have like MySpace. We had Yahoo chat groups. Mm. And I logged into a Yahoo chat group one day and saw people calling me ugly, and there was someone called me fat, and I was just like, this is terrible. Who wants to live like this, yeah, being judged on your appearance? And that just made me want to do more drugs.
Because it hurts, and that's how we deal
so
with it.
Yeah. Eventually, that ended, and I was still doing drugs, and I got into an accident. I was driving to my dealer's house, and I hit a car in front of me because I was just out of – I was like, I just wanted to go get some coke. Driving along, and that scared me so much. I thought for a second that I was dead because the airbag had like opened, mm-hmm, and there was just dust and everywhere. I don't know if you've ever broken an airbag, but it's
no, I haven't.
It's a very surreal feeling. And I was going probably 60 miles an hour, and I hit a stopped car.
Dang.
So it was just a very surreal feeling, and I just laid there in the car, and I sat there, and I was like, this is calm. I can finally just relax. Mm. And I thought I was dead, but luckily I wasn't. And that is the moment I was like, you know what? You have to change your life. And that was 2006. And I applied for my program, my mortuary science program. No, it was a little bit before that, actually. It was, I think I graduated from mortuary school in 2007. So this was a couple of years before that. And I got accepted. They only accept 40 students a year, so I was very lucky to be accepted into my mortuary program.
And why'd you want to do that?
I've always been fascinated with death since I was a kid. Always, my whole life.
Why? Were you subjected to any trauma or anything?
No, not that I can recall.
Yeah.
I remember seeing a dead animal once, and I was fascinated with it, and I just studied it all over because I wanted to know everything about the human body.
Wow.
And I was just so fascinated.
That's interesting.
And then my grandfather was the first person, my dad's dad, he died of alcoholism when he was 50. He was the first person I knew that had died. And I saw him in the hospital before he died. And that was very traumatic for me to see someone who was so full of life and then see them so gray and, you know, dying. And but more so than anything, it fascinated me that we had to die and that the body worked in this way where we, mm-hmm, and I just had to know everything about it. So when I was a kid, I would read medical books and just write down diseases that I thought were interesting. And just, I was completely fascinated by it. So I just always loved it. So that was a passion that I had. So I decided to go to school for that. And it was such an intense program, that I literally couldn't have anything to clutter my brain. There's a ton of memorization, linear equations and linear guides for, you have to know every vein and artery in the body.
Oh, gosh, and yeah.
It's chemical equations and anatomy and physiology. And as I said before, I've always loved school. I've always loved to learn. And that gave me a purpose. And those bodies, when I had my first embalming lab, and they would bring bodies in from the morgue that had been just left by their families, or they were street people. I felt such a connection to them, and I wanted to take care of them.
Jonathan Davis said a similar thing.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I just fell in love with making them look beautiful again, and making them, I talked to them, and I wanted them to feel good about what I had done. I get so teary-eyed just thinking about it, because I just love it so much. It's so hard for me to talk about it. It changed my life, dealing with death. I love it.
Hmm. That's beautiful. I was sitting here. I love that you're going there and feeling it.
Yeah. I think that it's the most beautiful thing you can do is to help someone who can no longer help themselves and make them feel special one more time, or make them look beautiful one more time. And then I fell in love with helping the families. And that just changed my life even more. And I worked for hospice. And sorry,
no,
I'm an emotional
don't apologize.
Person.
This is awesome.
I found myself so changed internally by being of service to people. And so that they didn't know, they saved my life.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing.
It was when you stop doing drugs, you're very emotional because you literally don't feel, especially a drug like cocaine, you don't feel anything really anymore. You just kind of become a very callous person in relationships and business dealings and everything. So when you stop, it's so weird. It's like being in a Disney cartoon. I think it's like the sun comes out. It's beautiful. It's sunny. The colors are so vibrant in life all of a sudden. And so
not for all people, though.
Maybe not for all people.
But you found your passion.
For me, and I'm not saying right away. There's bad days at first, and it takes a long time. I believe me, I had to flush cocaine down the toilet many, many times, dig through many carpets for cocaine nuggets before I got to the point where I could breathe and I was happy and I didn't need it anymore. So it's a struggle. So believe me, it's a very hard struggle.
But I love how you got into service, because
yes,
that's what many of us do.
I think that you have to do something like that in order to really become clean.
Mm-hmm. So let's throw in the song right now. We're not going to play all of it because it's a very long song, and we got to get back and be able to have some cool other stuff to talk about, mm-hmm. for sure. So we're here with Carla Harvey, and thank you for getting so vulnerable and
sorry
open.
I'm always vulnerable. I'm a girl. I'm terrible.
No, there's no need to apologize. It's beautiful. And I was thinking that some people at home are probably thinking, what a sicko, she likes to do, you know, mess with dead bodies. But I totally,
you make me sound like a sicko by saying
no,
like that.
But you know how people are. Some people would be like, oh, I can't imagine. But I totally get what you're saying.
I see the beauty in it because it's
praise, it's worship, it's honoring. And I know there's so much stigma about death, but death is as much a part of life as life is life.
It's the only guaranteed thing in life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that perspective that you brought in. So we're going to play a Pearl Jam song called Release.
Yes. And I was telling you, I don't even like Pearl Jam, but this song means a lot to me.
About how you transitioned out of the...
Yes, the lyrics are just, they really spoke to me when I was getting off drugs. Release me. And it also spoke to me about my father. And I realized that I had a lot of issues that I had to deal with and let go before I let go of my addiction. And releasing all of those feelings that I had from childhood helped me release my dependence on drugs. And so it all goes hand in hand.
I love it. So here we are with Carla Harvey on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear, and this is Pearl Jam Release. We got to fade it out because there's so much more to talk about. We only have a few minutes left. But this is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM station, human-crafted radio, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. I'm here with Carla Harvey, singer of Butcher Babies, who's just telling her incredible story about overcoming cocaine and how come you like that Pearl Jam song Release. You had to release a lot of the damage and emotional and other types of trauma from your childhood mm-hmm. to get into sobriety.
To get off cocaine. I mean, a lot of us that have used, we're really masking the real problems that we need to
100%.
Deal with. And so that for me was what I needed to do. And I help people now. I'm a life coach, a grief coach. Now I really missed helping people.
That's so cool.
So that's what I do now in my spare time when I'm not on the road. Even when I'm on the road, I do Skype sessions I'll rent a hotel room and do Skype sessions all day and help people. It's really, I hate to say the word blessed, but blessed, it's so overused, that I've been put in the public eye and I'm able to make music and put my heart out there. Music is such a cathartic thing. Mm-hmm. That also changed my life, being able to write and perform songs that, detail my life and Heidi's life. For both of us, it's been extremely cathartic. And for people to hear the lyrics that we've written together and respond to them and find peace in them for themselves. So my coaching is taking that to another level, and helping people that really need it.
I love that. And I one time had dinner with this therapist. She, had all these letters behind her name, and she's like, I was talking about spirituality, and she's like, I just don't understand how you could play with corn and be spiritual. And I'm sure some people would say, Butcher Babies, how could that? It doesn't sound obvious to maybe a large chunk of people. But what you don't realize is the same reason this show's here. We talk about the dark stuff. We can talk about the stuff that's heavy and tough to deal with, and that's what helps people. If we sang about lollipops and rainbows all the time, the people who are struggling would feel like nobody knows what.
Well, heavy metal for me was always the first time I heard Metallica, thrash metal, it sounded on the outside like I felt on the inside as a child, mm-hmm. That's what attracted me to it. And I believe that the rage that you can get out with your mouth or with an instrument that really helps you heal. If you can get it out in a positive way instead of beating someone's face in or doing drugs, screaming for me is a cathartic, positive response to a bad day.
I love it. And that's where music came from. Before there was pop stars, it was just expression, or it was homage to, God or whatever. That's beautiful. I really have really enjoyed this interview and getting to know you. It's selfishly, I love doing this radio show for this, and we sit right here, and it's intimate.
No, it's a nice setup. I like it.
It's cool, right? Way better than when I was over there. So, what do you got going on now? What's Butcher Babies up to?
We are going to head to Europe pretty soon. We have our third album out. It's called Lilith, and we have a song on the radio right now called Look What We've Done. So definitely check it out. Check out Lilith in our radio song. We're very proud. And we're cool. Just, how metal bands do it this day. We just hit the pavement and go out there and do what we can and try to keep everything afloat. But I'm so proud of how far all of us have come in the last, almost 10 years now we've been a band. It's crazy.
I love seeing the glow when you talk about it and the passion that you take into it. It's beautiful.
You have to have passion to be a musician these days.
And I don't know. And you're saying how it is when you're in a metal band. I think a lot of people at home don't realize. They think when you have a record deal that people would be like, you got a Ferrari and a mansion. No, dude. I'm playing at 7:00. I've got $35.
Yeah, it's true. It's a very hard road. For those of you that don't know, we don't make a ton of money. I'm lucky that I have my art in, to subsidize my living, or else I wouldn't be able to play music at all. It's very, very hard for musicians these days. But if you're passionate about it and you love it. You got to do it.
Well, that's what Ray Luzier, Korn's drummer, always, we always, you know, that's what he would tell people. Don't do it for the money. If you do it because you love to play, that's the right reason.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to make money these
days.
And hey,
you might make some money and see the world. We do make a little money and we get to see the world. We're going to Russia in October and, you know, that's a pretty awesome life. We'll be everywhere from, you know, Germany to, we go all over Europe and then to Russia. So, at least I don't have to pay for my travel, right?
Yeah, I love that part about touring. So also, and we didn't talk about it much, but Carla is an amazing illustrator. You got to see her artwork. You have a comic book out that was Butcher Babies. So if you can check, she sells stuff on her Instagram.
Yeah, I have a website. If you just go to CarlaHarvey.com, you can see everything. I have tons of prints for sale, tons of art. Art is what keeps me together on the road. Art is for people who need to keep their sobriety in check. Having a hobby is the most awesome thing. For me, drawing all day long is what I do so that my brain doesn't wander and put me in bad situations that I shouldn't be in. So I highly recommend getting a hobby like that.
Yeah.
But my hobby has been also a lifelong passion for me.
So it's cool if you want to support Carla as an artist and know now you know a little bit about her and what the energy that's going into those paintings, you can go support her in that way. And so what I thought was cool about this story was that the solution is very much the same. It was finding something you're passionate about and helping others and turning that perspective of life to giving other people love and support. And that's one way that we all recover.
Yeah, I just think that when you are helping people, you just feel so whole that you don't need to fill yourself with all the crap that you used to. Mm-hmm. You have a purpose. Everyone needs a purpose. It's human nature. You have to feel like you mean something.
100%. Fulfillment is the way to go. So I've really enjoyed this. We got to get out of here. This has been Carla Harvey here in studio with me, your host, Wes Geer, on Rock to Recovery Radio. And if you're still listening, Rock to Recovery 3 concert with Steel Panther, honoring Moby and Tommy Vex. Carla Harvey will be there. Fonda Theater in Hollywood, Saturday, September 15th. Coming up in 1 month from today. Thanks for listening. We're out of here.